Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. Today, we are going to go through the news events of the week. We have with us our legal and political analyst, Binyamin Moalem. Thanks for being with us, Binyamin.
Pleasure.
I'd like to share with our listeners a few words about you. Binyamin is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. He's worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel and has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes much of his time to curating and explaining political events and foreign affairs on his Instagram page, which is very popular, by Moalem. The BY is for your name, right, Binyamin?
Yeah. Middle name Yisrael.
So B-Y Moalem, yeah. But it works because it sounds like by Moalem, by you. So today we're going to talk about a few things that we have in our notepad here. We're going to talk about the Iran-Israel war and how these countries and their foreign aides are preparing to not reach a deal. And we're going to talk about Israel's budget, which was just passed. It was actually kind of miraculous because, first of all, it's the largest budget that Israel has seen to date since 1948. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about what that means. And we're also going to talk about something that is a little bit of a touchy subject, especially, I think, here in Israel, the death penalty for terrorists, and how that is making waves through the legislation here in Israel. So thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
I always like to localize things. I say that there's not a lot of local politics in Israel and that there's not a lot of local news in Israel because we're a country of 10 million people and about the size of the state of New Jersey, so we're pretty small. But locally here in central Israel, just this morning, we had cluster munitions dropping all over the city. I heard it, you heard it right outside, and cars have been burnt to a crisp. And, you know, we're really going through it. And at the northern border, people are having very, very, very little time, sometimes even 5 seconds to enter bomb shelters at the northern border. So definitely here in Israel, war rages on. Binyamin, what has it been like for you running in and out of the bomb shelters this last month?
Well, like for everybody, there's element of fatigue that sets in. I think we've had in Tel Aviv something like 133 sirens over the past month. Now, here, most of those sirens came from Iranian missiles, so we usually get a 5 minute or so pre-warning, get close to a shelter, and then you hear the siren, which gives you 90 seconds to take shelter. Oftentimes, this happens in the middle of the night, so there have been weeks where we haven't gotten very much sleep, but take it all in perspective, you know, it beats not having shelter and not getting a warning and being able to take cover when there is a missile attack. And though in northern Israel now, thankfully, they are starting to get a few more extra seconds when Hezbollah attacks because Israel has pushed deeper into Lebanon, and that has pushed Hezbollah rocket fire further north, which gives residents of northern Israel a few more valuable seconds to take cover when the siren goes off.
I did not know that. Thank you for explaining how that works. I've been very concerned about the north because we've seen, unfortunately, casualties. And when I say casualties, I don't mean people being taken to the hospital for anxiety and trauma. I mean people who have been killed riding a bicycle or in their car and not able to get enough time warning. And unfortunately, in one situation, actually friendly fire from the IDF.
Yeah, somebody was riding close to the border, and there was an unfortunate accident, and he was hit during, apparently it was sometime around or another rocket attack from Hezbollah. A woman was killed when shrapnel fell on her while she was taking cover in the middle of a road during one of the attacks, and a few soldiers were killed from missile fire in southern Lebanon.
Absolutely, and every day these numbers that are rolling out, even when it's just one person, we're all very affected by it. We're a very small country. Everyone's very deeply interconnected. Last note I'll say on that, which I think is really special to Israel, is that the man who was killed by friendly fire in the north of Israel by IDF, a member of his family came out and said that they didn't want the soldiers responsible for it to feel guilty and bad because they themselves had been in a similar position in the army, in the Israel Defense Forces, and they know that it could happen and that it's possible. And I think it's a very unique to Israel response. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's very sad. It's something that whoever is behind it has to live with for the rest of their lives, and I can't imagine what that must be like. So I'm sure it offers some measure of, if a measure of encouragement or comfort can be offered, that I'm sure that's important to them.
So take us through what's happening on the international stage in terms of trying to reach a deal with Iran. We know that President Trump of the United States loves to make a deal. Are we going to get one?
Well, it depends who you ask. I would say that it does not look very promising right now, though President Trump has sounded very optimistic in his posts on Truth Social and in other statements he has made to the media. Now, he posted yesterday that he hopes to be getting a deal very soon, but if not, Karg Island, the island through which 90% of Iranian oil exports move through, would be obliterated. And that kind of points to some plans the U.S. might be making in the event a deal is not made. And we also know that Iran is similarly preparing for such an event. The U.S. is reportedly preparing for the possibility of sending ground troops into either Karg Island, which is a little bit further north in the Persian Gulf, that's the oil terminal, or one of three islands that are on the Straits of Hormuz, because since the war began, it has been very difficult for other oil-producing countries in the Gulf states to move ships and with oil through the Strait of Hormuz, which, in addition to the fact that Iran's capability of exporting oil has been hampered by sanctions and war, now, they are not unable to, they have been unable to ship out their oil because of the Iranian threats to the Strait of Hormuz. Now, the Strait of Hormuz is that little bottleneck between Iran and United Arab Emirates, and Oman really is the country that's on the point there. And this is causing global oil prices to skyrocket, which I'm sure everybody is feeling at the pumps. And in some other less developed countries that don't have their own oil, they've been facing shortages. So what Iran now is threatening to do is not only keep it closed now during the war, but they want to charge tolls to ships traversing the strait. Now, this is something they did not do prior. And in doing so, they hope to raise more money through tolls, charging tolls to thrift ships, than they do through their oil exports, which means that they intend on charging a lot of money for ships to go through, something that the U.S. is not going to allow. It would be a tremendous loss for the U.S. that before the war, ships moved through the Strait of Hormuz for free, and now they're not going to allow Iran to charge tolls for these ships. So this is one of the reasons why the United States is planning to either take military action in those areas to ensure Iran is unable to strangle the Strait of Hormuz, or reach a diplomatic deal that obviates the need for any sort of military action in that area of Iran. Now, a report today in the Wall Street Journal, or last night in the U.S., said that the U.S., that President Trump might be willing to end the war without a resolution for the Strait of Hormuz, kind of punting that for a later time. Unclear what that would mean, because if Iran then goes in and starts charging tolls, not only will he have problems in the United States politically, the entire world will be up in arms over that. So, I kind of take the report, not necessarily with a grain of salt on the reporting, but more on what the President Trump's actual plan is. I don't see him just letting that go. Another thing that we have to keep an eye on is, of course, what Iran plans to do with its nuclear program. Now, until now, Iran is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits it from obtaining nuclear weapons. Now, that has not stopped them from doing everything possible to get up into the line of building a bomb, if not having crossed it, because they haven't actually built one yet.
And they're just enriching enough uranium.
Well, yeah, prior to the 12-day war, they had enriched 450 kilograms, about 1,000 pounds, of 60% uranium. Now, that's a small technical step away from 90% uranium needed to build a nuclear bomb. And that's enough uranium to build, I believe, 11 atomic bombs. So Very close in terms of what else is needed. Now, they would need to still enrich. Now, they, as far as we know, they no longer have enrichment facilities because they've been destroyed. They also have need to complete whatever R&D is necessary to build the actual warhead with the uranium. But the big step of getting the uranium to the point where it's ready to be put into a missile is a very significant step towards building a bomb.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So 11 nuclear bombs. How much damage can one nuclear bomb do?
Well, I guess I don't know it also depends on the size of the bomb. You know, there's different size bombs, but Israel's a very small country, and atomic bomb inflicts severe damage over a very large area. Not only the area that it actually destroys, but also there's nuclear fallout, and Israel's not a big country. So 11 bombs could do quite a bit of damage on a country as small as Israel.
That's why I'm asking, because I understand
it's not something that... this is why Israel went to war in June to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, because they could not let Iran cross that line of becoming a nuclear-powered regime, which would then pretty much prevent any future war, because that would almost guarantee their use of the bomb. Because...
Now, how does this affect the United States?
So we talked about this last time, and the United States also is threatened because Iran is the number one sponsor of world terrorism. They, if they had a nuclear weapon, they could give one of those weapons to one of their terror proxies to use in any place in the world, really. And, you know, again, obviously it's not so simple, but it's something that they could do. And giving this regime nuclear weapons would basically shield it from any future attacks, and that would basically allow them to continue funding their terror proxies and continuing to wreak havoc on the rest of the world. And so what the U.S. is considering is a ground operation, and this has been reported for a few weeks now, that would allow the United States to go into Iran, find that 450 kilograms of enriched uranium, and remove it from Iran. Now, we'd have to know exactly where this is being held. Reportedly, it's under rubble at one of the nuclear sites that were bombed during the 12-day war. And this is very important as far as Israel's concerned, because even though Iran's nuclear program has been destroyed, having this uranium gives them a huge head start on a future program, meaning the war ends, they'll start rebuilding their centrifuges, they'll start rebuilding their R&D programs, and then they can take this uranium, put it into one of these new centrifuges, enrich it to 90%, and build a bomb much quicker than if they did not have this 450 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. So these are two things that, you know, as far as Israel's concerned, the war cannot end with Iran having this stockpile of enriched uranium. From the U.S. perspective, they need, you know, they need to show a win. And if the regime doesn't fall, and the regime could fall, it might take a few months after the war is over, you know, the United States needs to show that we have guaranteed that Iran does not become a nuclear-powered state. Iran cannot threaten its our allies, I mean, U.S. allies in the region with its ballistic missile program. And it does no longer has the ability to fund terror proxies that perform terrorist attacks, not only against Israel, but also against the rest of the world.
From my readings and understanding, the Iranians have been at least outwardly suggesting that they are not going to back down, that they are not going to strike a deal. And from a New York Times report that I read previously, the more they are antagonized by the United States, the more they are going to double down. And I think there's such a concept that some of these, some nations, it's a no-go. It's a no starting point. This is, you know, we're not going to negotiate what we do in our home. So what does it look like if there's a refusal to reach a deal?
So, as I said, the United States might have to go in and take Karg Island. They might have to take one of the islands that are on the Strait of Hormuz to prevent Iran from putting a stranglehold on the shipping lane. It might require a ground operation to seize the uranium there. Now, from the air, Israel and the United States can destroy pretty much, you know, Israel says that within the next week or so, it will have destroyed 90% of Iran's military production capabilities. meaning their ability to rebuild their military after the war is over will be significantly hampered. Now, Israel or the United States cannot force regime change, but they could weaken it so much that it will take years, if not decades, to rebuild what they had in terms of military capabilities. But what's very important is that they cannot threaten the region or the world, either with terrorism or with economic terrorism in the Strait of Hormuz, or with, you know, threatening the global oil supply, and that they cannot threaten the world with actual terrorism.
Very, very interesting. One question that I have is, can you put into perspective for us the difference in size between Israel and Iran?
So Israel is about the size of New Jersey, and Iran is three times the size of Texas, if that helps.
So we're talking about a very, very small country destabilizing and 90% demilitarizing a country.
Production capability is not necessarily, the military itself. They've got a standing army. Several thousand have been killed, but this is a very, very large military.
And so we're just talking about their capabilities to shoot missiles at us.
Not just shoot missiles, but other sorts of armaments and other sorts of military, air defenses and other things that a military needs to defend itself and to perform offensive, to have offensive capabilities, will be degraded.
Thank you for explaining that to us. So how much longer do you think that this is going to go on for?
I do not know. What we know is it was Vice President Vance over the weekend said soon. Marco Rubio said 2 to 4 weeks over the weekend. That's how much time the U.S. needs to finish its objectives in terms of its target list. Israel says that's more than halfway through its list of targets and missions in Iran. But Israel is happy to go along as the U.S. needs, because, you know, there are not just military targets, there are regime economic targets. You know, the regime makes a lot of money off of its oil supply through, you know, to the countries that ships oil to that do not care for the U.S. sanctions, like mainly China. But a big steel plant where the regime makes a lot of money off of was recently destroyed by Israel. So there are other economic targets that Israel and the United States could strike in Iran to prevent, to hamper the regime's ability to raise money, which is what it needs, especially when it's crippled by all the sanctions that's been under.
Let's move into more internal things that are happening here in Israel, to our little country of 10 million people. I want to talk about the budget. We just had a budget passed, which I actually think, being that today is Tuesday, March 31st, being that Tuesday was the deadline for this budget, the fact that the budget was passed a whole 24 hours early.
48,
right? It was Sunday or Monday?
It was 2 nights ago.
It was Sunday two night. Nights ago.
The night between Sunday and Monday.
Overnight between Sunday and Monday, I understood that it was a very late meeting and that it was interrupted many times by missile alerts and things like that. People had to come in and come out. Pretty impressive for Israel, which is usually getting that budget in right up until the deadline, or needing to get an extension.
So I don't think you can get an extension on this. The budget, if the budget isn't passed by March 31st, elections are automatically triggered 3 months later.
Right. So during that time, there's like kind of a pause.
So here's the thing. I don't think it was ever really in question that this government was going to pass a budget. You have two very polarized political camps in Israel, and the current government doesn't have anything to gain by triggering early elections. Like, again, elections are scheduled currently for October 27th, so not that far away. Elections will happen sometime between now and then. And the government figured, you know, we might as well pass the budget. We might as well have enough time to finish any things that are left on our agenda, Iran war being the main issue. Netanyahu, perhaps if the Iran war, the result of the war ends up being far better than, you know, anybody really imagined at this point, and the regime falls, that might lead to normalization with Saudi Arabia, and the prime minister would want as much time as possible to get all those wins heading into the next election. Now, what might happen between now and then, the prime minister might say, like, you know, okay, after the war in Iran is over, and Israel has some very significant wins there, he might say, well, I want to ride that into an election. Let's go to elections now and move elections up by several months so that he could ride that momentum into the next election. So, you know, you would need a 3-month period between the time elections are declared and the election actually happens. So perhaps he would have it sometime in the summer. The Haredi parties who had been threatening to leave the coalition because of, you know, and they actually did leave the coalition, but they kept it up from the outside over the lack of a draft law. They agreed to vote for the budget again, despite the fact there was no draft law on condition it would be brought up again after the budget is passed. So something to look to in the summer, the Knesset summer session after the Passover recess, to see whether they decide to topple the government because of a lack of a draft law. But they don't have much leverage because it's not like the opposition is going to take them in and give them more than what the current coalition is willing to give them. And finally, when it comes to dates for the election, we talked about October 27th being the current date. If it's moved up, there's going to be some question over how far to move it up. October 27th is not the greatest date for Netanyahu because it's 3 weeks after the October 7th anniversary. So that's going to be in people's minds. He doesn't want people to be thinking about that because he was prime minister, obviously, during then. Then if you move it up from before the holidays, well, you don't want to do it in the middle of the summer when people are on summer vacation. You don't want to do it too close to the holidays, you know, Rosh Hashanah and the Jewish holidays in September because people are out of town, especially many voters of Haredi parties who are would-be partners with Netanyahu. They go to Uman for Rosh Hashanah pilgrimages.
Where is Uman?
In Ukraine for Rosh Hashanah pilgrimages. And
You have to explain. Yes.
So there is a grave site there of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov that many people go to pray there for during Rosh Hashanah. And so the best possible date for Netanyahu, if he wants to move the elections up by a couple of months, might be September 1st. That's usually the first day of school, so everyone's back from summer vacation. The holidays, it's about a week and a half or 2 weeks away from Rosh Hashanah. So that's kind of one of the dates people have been talking about. But at the end of the day, anything could happen between now and then. And one thing is for certain, there will be elections in the between now and the end of October.
I remember because I was here through so many government redos for a stretch of 6 to 7 years where there was election after election after election. That so when what happens when the budget is not agreed on? They need to do a new government and then do a new budget.
Well, right. But usually what happens is elections are triggered. This is what happened in 2021. That was the short-lived government between Netanyahu and Benny Gantz. They did not pass a budget, which triggered new elections, and that led to the Bennett-Lapid government, which lasted for a year and a half.
So,
oh, and one more thing, trivia about this government. It's the second time in Israel's history that a government has passed its fourth budget. Usually, as we get closer to elections, various factions, they want to jockey for more better position, play hardball, causes the government to clash, They can then go to their voting base and say, hey, we pressed for what you guys wanted. We didn't get it, so we went to elections. We're not seeing that now because, as I said, there's not much leverage the smaller parties have on Netanyahu here because they're not going to be part of an alternative government. And so the first time since 1988, which was a national unity government between Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir, that lasted its full term. This government now has a chance to become the first government since then to last a full term and pass after passing its fourth budget, unless one of the parties or the prime minister decides that there is a reason that would be beneficial to them to move elections up.
Wow. So many parts of politics there. Okay, switching over to Israel's budget, the largest in Israel's history to date, about 700 billion shekels and 271 billion US dollars, if you're somebody that can more easily think in dollars. Take us through that.
All right, so you've got 142 billion shekels that were earmarked for defense. Obviously, that's going to be the biggest one. Israel's defense costs have skyrocketed over the last 3 years since the October 7th war began. I believe the 2023 budget's defense allocation was something like 75 billion shekels, so it's almost double since then. Other allocations have had to tighten their belts. Other ministries have had to be spending less so that money could be allocated towards defense spending. the VAT taxes in Israel went up from 17 to 18% a couple of years ago. So, yeah, wars are expensive. It is being felt, even though Israel's economy has been surprisingly resilient through all this and has actually grown over the past 3 years.
And Israel's economy was surprisingly resilient throughout COVID as well, which was not the case for a lot of other countries around the world.
Yes, that is correct. And it was also during the economic collapse of 2007-2008. Israel's had the was one, I think, one of two Western economies that had net growth during during that economic crash.
Wow. A little haven on the Levant. So, well, I actually want to make one cute note about that, which is just a sort of an example of what Israeli life is like and what Israeli resilience is like, that this morning after I came in from being in the bomb shelter for the second time today, the ambulances were going by. I was hearing emergency first responders getting to the scene. There was a cluster munition that fell very, very close to my home. And I was just hearing the ruckus and hoping that nobody had died or was hurt. And I looked up at the hotel nearby and I saw three workers setting up the pool on the top of the hotel. They were unlocking the lounge chairs and wiping off the bar because today is March 31st. It's quite warm outside. April is tomorrow. And so here we are in Israel. Passover is a day away and bombs are falling. Bomblets are falling, ruining people's homes, lives, killing people. And business is continuing as usual.
Well, you got to keep living your life. Otherwise, you know.
You got to keep going. You got to bring those lounge chairs out. There is something that I want you to take us through because it is a little hairy and I think it might be a touchy subject for maybe some historical reasons that you might know here in Israel, which is the death penalty. The death penalty has always been a little touchy in Israel. Have we ever had a full-blown death penalty in Israel since 1948?
Eichmann.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And it was a special circumstance.
Right, for a special law for Nazi war criminals.
Right. So take us through, what is this new penalty for terrorists and why was that a case for the Nazis special? And it only came to be one time that the death penalty was exacted. Is that right?
John Demjanjuk was sentenced to death. He was also convicted of being a Nazi guard, of being Ivan the Terrible. That conviction was overturned. The Supreme Court said there was a lack of evidence. This was in 1993, and he was released from prison. But that was based on a special law for Nazi war criminals. When it comes to terrorists, now there is, prior to this law that was passed yesterday, and I'll get a little deeper into it, there is a death penalty on the books for terrorism. It could be administered or set in military courts. Terrorists could be sentenced to death. However, it is exceedingly difficult for that to happen. I believe there was one instance where a military court did sentence someone to death, but it got overturned by the Supreme Court and there was no execution. But the goal of this law was to make it much easier for military courts and civil courts in some situations to sentence terrorists to death. Under the terms of the law, in short, there's two sections of the law. One applies to the West Bank, and one applies to Israel. The one in the West Bank would apply to non-Israelis, so meaning Palestinian terrorists who kill out of nationalistic motivation. And the one in Israel applies to anybody who commits murder with the motivation of denying Israel as a Jewish state, or Israel's right to exist, rather. It's denying Israel's right to exist, which basically is a definition to try to put somebody who is a terrorist but happens to be an Israeli citizen to be able to impose the death penalty in such a situation. Now, there's going to be, there already is actually, last night, not minutes if not hours after the law was passed, a petition was filed with the Supreme Court to challenge the legality of the law. The argument is that the first part of the law that applies just to Palestinians in the West Bank, that the Knesset does not have jurisdiction to enact such a law in the West Bank, because the West Bank has not been annexed by Israel, and is therefore subject to a different set of laws, military law and the such. So therefore, the law cannot apply in the West Bank. And as far as the law that the part of the law that applies to Israeli citizens, that law is unconstitutional. Parts of the law, I think it's the first part of the law that, you know, doesn't really allow for appeals. And mandates the death penalty in certain situations, and allows for a 2-to-1 in a 3-judge panel. A 2-to-1 vote for the death penalty would allow for the death penalty instead of a 3-0 vote on the panel. So I think that this law has an uphill battle from a legal perspective. I don't see the law being allowed to stand by the Supreme Court in the way it's currently drafted. What is interesting is that the opposition, Yisrael Beiteinu party, Avigdor Lieberman, his party, he has been a long proponent of death penalties for terrorists, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, whose party was sponsored this law. And his party voted for the law. He said that he would vote for it if Netanyahu, who initially was opposed to the law, would vote for it. Netanyahu did vote for it, and Lieberman's party voted for the law as well. As I said, this law has an uphill battle from a legal perspective, and it will be interesting to see how the court rules in this case.
What's the pro and con of a society having a death penalty on the books?
What the argument is, and those proponents of the law said that they're claiming that the Shin Bet said that this would be a deterrent to terrorists, meaning if a terrorist knows that he could be sentenced to death and not just shot at during the commission of the attack, they might be deterred from committing the attack. Those opposed to it say that, there are people who are opposed to the death penalty in general, and there's, you know, I'm sure everybody's familiar with, just on moral grounds, the idea that government should not be putting people to death, but also that this law, and I think some of the petition goes into this, that this law is a little bit too cavalier in allowing for, you know, the capital punishment, and that, you know, by limiting the right to appeal in certain situations, or not requiring a unanimous vote amongst the panel of judges, that will inhibit the rights of the defendants in this case. And other people say that this might motivate more terrorist attacks, because if there's somebody who's going to be executed, in a terrorist who's going to be executed in a few weeks, a few months, that might motivate hostage situations, or, you know, God forbid, or other attacks.
Very, very, very interesting. Question about the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, depending on how you call it. Aren't a lot of these incidents of Palestinians attacking Jews happening in the West Bank? So the fact that this law can't be extended into events that are taking place in the West Bank, it sounds a little confusing to me. Can you share?
Sorry, can you clarify the question?
You said that this law cannot be carried out in the West Bank.
Oh, so what I meant by that is the law that applies to Palestinians, the part of the law that applies to Palestinians, the Israeli government has never annexed the West Bank. So the West Bank is not subject to Israeli law. It's subject to military law and other administrative laws that apply just to the West Bank. The argument that petitioners to the Supreme Court are making, as far as the part of the law that applies to the West Bank, to Palestinians in the West Bank, is that the Knesset doesn't have jurisdiction to enact a law that applies just to Palestinians in the West Bank, because they are not subject to Israel law, because Israel never annexed the West Bank. And that's the argument there, meaning that they're subject to a different set of laws in the West Bank, and therefore the Knesset cannot say that this is what the law is going to apply in territory that is not sovereign Israeli territory.
Absolutely. However, a lot of the violence that could be applicable, or could be this law could apply to, is happening in the West Bank.
Correct. But that's usually dealt with military courts. That's what you will have people who are proponents of the law, and the government will defend the law by saying, well, you know, ultimately, whether it's military law, that's all dictated by the Israeli civil government, because the military is subject to the decisions of the cabinet. And so there will be this argument that, yes, it all flows ultimately from power that is granted to it by the Knesset. That'll be a question for the court to decide.
Thank you for taking us through that, Benjamin, and through all of these points. There was something that I want to bring in because it is seasonal and it is the time of the holiday, which is that, first of all, there were cluster munitions that hit just outside of the old city.
And inside the old city.
And inside the old city of Jerusalem. And there has been a limited access for people to enter and leave the old city. If I'm understanding correctly, it's being reserved just for residents that actually need to go inside to be able to reach their homes. Now, this has been a challenge for people of faith and priests and cardinals that are trying to get in. Sunday of this week was Palm Sunday ahead of Easter, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Prime Minister Netanyahu originally doubled down that there was going to be no access to it for safety and security reasons, following some pressure, especially from U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. That decision was reversed. So, first of all, how real are these security measures that that Israel was trying to impose, and can you share any analysis that you have with us on that?
Sure. So there was a misunderstanding, I think, the way that it was portrayed by some in the press, that Israel was not allowing Christian worship in the old city, which is not what happened. Israel passed a regulation. There was a these rules that there cannot be gatherings of 50 or more people anywhere in Israel, such gathering needs to be close to a shelter. Now, this also affected prayers in the Temple Mount. The last couple weeks of Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, there were no prayers on the Temple Mount. And if you were to believe what some people were saying on social media, that Israel was not allowing Muslim prayer, that is not true. It's just that there was a safety requirement there, because typically tens of thousands of people attend these prayers. And if there was an attack, you know, this decision was done for the safety of the individuals who would otherwise be praying on the Temple Mount. And the same thing here when it comes to the prayers at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It was a police decision. I think maybe had higher-ups been involved ahead of time, perhaps this political faux pas would have been avoided. But ultimately, the Prime Minister got involved, President got involved, and an arrangement will be made for Good Friday and Easter Sunday services to be held with the presence of the Latin Patriarch, Pier Battista Pizzaballa. He is the cardinal, Catholic cardinal of the area, of the Holy Land, and so he will be allowed to hold services. I don't know what the regulations are for those services. I'm assuming they're not going to be, you know, standard in terms of how many people will be allowed. But the same also applies to the Western Wall, the annual priestly blessings that are held every year during Passover and Sukkot. The one scheduled for Passover will be limited to 50 people. And this is an event that is usually attended by tens of thousands
of
people.
Where is this event?
At the Western Wall.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is not something that was discrimination against Christians or discrimination against Muslims. Jews are in the same category here, and the services will be limited.
Can you give us a Passover and Easter send-off?
Well, happy Passover to everybody, and I wish everybody a good holiday.
We here at the Israel Daily News are grateful for your listenership, your readership. The Israel Daily News is actually skyrocketing with listenership, viewership right now. And we're so, so happy to be able to give people not just a report, but a report from here in Israel. Something that I really feel passionately about is that a lot of channels from around the world send a correspondent to Israel for a week, 2 weeks, and I don't think that you can really get the story of what's going on in Israel unless you're here for a substantial amount of time, unless you feel it, unless you yourself are running into the bomb shelters, unless you yourself know people that are living all throughout the country. And so I'm very, very proud that we're able to not just give the report, but that we're able to give the report with nuance and with understanding, and that we're able to say, hey, actually, that didn't happen. We're here. We feel it. We are recipients of said restrictions. You know, it's not just a report we're reading, it's something that we're living. So I'm very proud of that. And sometimes when I'm out in the field and I see foreign reporters, and actually one time it happened that I said, I'm Shana Fold, and a journalist from India came out and said, you're Shana Fold? And I said, yes. And he said, I listen to the Israel Daily News podcast every day when I'm not here. And he comes in, his station sends him here for 1 or 2 weeks at a time when there's a flare-up. And in the meantime, he's getting his news from us. So I'm very proud of that. And I send everybody off today. First of all, a little information. We're not going to be back until maybe the end of Passover. There's a restriction, a prohibition on doing work during the week of Passover. We have a high holy day that is beginning Wednesday evening at sundown. Everyone, all the Jews are going to be in their homes on the Seder. Something actually that Rabbi Jonathan Feldman, whom I work with for Tribe Tel Aviv, said last night at our model Seder, where we did a run through of the Seder with chocolate and wine. He said that one of the things that is noted in the story of Passover is that we are commanded to be in our homes. And, you know, when the killing of the firstborn was happening, the Jews were told, this is the plague, this is the story from Egypt, the Jews were told to stay in their homes. And we here are being told to stay in our homes and to stay local, not do too much traveling, be next to your bomb shelter. And so we're reliving some stories that the Jewish people know. And we will be eating with our closest family and friends, whether that's in proximity or familial. And so we're going to be a few days off from the Israel Daily News. We'll be picking it up again next week. We're also going to be offline on Wednesday evening of next week, because that will be the last night of Passover. So we send you off with blessings for the season. And like I said yesterday, well, first of all, I'm wearing green because Passover is the holiday Hag Ha'aviv, the holiday of spring. And we're hoping at the Israel Daily News that we have some green pastures out on the horizon in front of us, that war should come to an end and everybody should be able to resume their lives and rebuild, no more munitions falling overhead. And Benjamin, thank you so much for being a beautiful, beautiful addition to the Israel Daily News this year.
Thank you, Shana. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Happy holiday. Happy Passover.